right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
These are the top stories. Vote counting is underway in Iraq for Sunday's early parliamentary elections as officials put the voter turnout at 41%. The Algerian president says his country is not a French colony any longer, demanding total respect from France. A woman is killed and 17 police officers injured as Chilean police clash with protesters during a rally by the indigenous Mapuche community in Santiago. Vote counting is underway for Sunday's early parliamentary elections in Iraq. The Electoral Commission has put the voter turnout at 41%, lower than the last election that was held in 2018. Nearly 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots for 329 seats of for the 329-seat legislature that should be. Around 3,500 candidates are in the fray. This is Iraq's fifth parliamentary election since the ouster of former dictator Saddam Hussein in 2003. Sunday's vote was called 1 year earlier than it was scheduled in response to 2019 street protests over economic woes and high-level corruption. To fill us in with the latest information on those parliamentary elections, I'm joined by my own colleague, Wissam Bahrani, who has traveled for us to Baghdad. Wissam, tell us about today and the aftermath of elections.
As you said, these are preliminary results that have been announced. 41%, which is, some would say that's a low turnout, and some would say that's a good turnout considering the circumstances that the country is facing, security threats and issues and the such. In any case, I think questions will be asked because not a lot is expected to change in Parliament. These are, according to party officials and candidates who received the results of the new electronic system, they received the results, a list of the results, so they have an idea as to how the results would have unfolded. And we're expecting an official announcement as to the exact turnout, and which is expected to remain at that number even lower than 2018, where 44.5% had turned out. And we're also at around 3 p.m. expecting a general announcement of, you know, who won how many seats. But again, according to party officials and party spokespeople, spokespersons and the such, they have an idea because they've got a copy of the results, and they indicate that you've probably at most going to see a 5% swing in parliament, and that's going to lead to a bit of questions that are going to be raised as to, you know, we put all this energy and resources into this election. We made it 1 year earlier. It was slated for next year. And at the end of the day, there were so many independent candidates. Why didn't the people? Why didn't those who opposed, for example, for instance, those who perhaps opposed the parties that maintained their seats over the past decade or so, why didn't they go out and choose the vote for independent candidates that would have swung the direction of parliament?
About the turnout, because I guess that's all we can talk about right now, you know, because as you mentioned, the results are not fully out yet. But let's just remember the Electoral Commission putting this number at 41%. Obviously, is comparing the numbers so far with the numbers at such a state in 2018, not a full counting. So if we take that to be true right now, let's just imagine for a moment, and if we take that to be true, what can we imagine, what would you know about the reasons that could contribute to this lower turnout vis-a-vis 2018?
Yeah, you know, you can put that down to several factors for the low turnout. If you would consider that a low, you know, if some are considering that as a low turnout, one is that the polls closed at 6 p.m., which is a bit unusual. When you ask the authorities of the Electoral Commission, they say that was down to the new biometric system that shuts down automatically at 6 p.m. But usually people, Iraqis, they 6 p.m., you know, in the afternoon, 3 p.m., after 12 p.m. until about 4 p.m., Iraqis don't even go out on the street. It's so hot. So if they had perhaps extended that to midnight, they would have seen a stronger turnout. Another factor could be that the protest movement that initiated this whole election process wasn't as popular as perhaps some had viewed or considered. Remember, they had very legitimate rights at the beginning during the demonstrations for jobs, better services, better infrastructure, more vital services, sanitation, and everything. But then those demonstrations took a turn. They turned quite ugly, and that was a limited number of people at the time. And those demonstrations turned into very violent rallies that attacked security posts of security personnel. So it turns out that those protests were not as popular as some had imagined. And because you had at the same time party leaders such as the head of the second largest current, the outgoing parliament, the second largest parliament, Heidi El-Amri, who on so many occasions said, go out and vote for, don't vote for for the party that you like, vote for the candidate that you like.
Okay, many thanks. That's an update from our anchor turned correspondent these days in Baghdad, Wissam Bahrani, who brought us up to date with the latest situation from within his own country. Of course, we're going to talk to you more as the results pour in. For now, I'm going to let you go, Wissam. Thank you. And we're moving with another story now. Tehran says that Washington, or Iran, has blamed Europe's inaction, I should say, for the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal and its violation
of the landmark international accord. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman made the comments during his weekly presser. Said Khatibzadeh said the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal were passive observers of Washington's violations and audacities. Khatibzadeh underlined the signatories must reassure Tehran that such violations would never happen again. He also accused Germany of failing to implement a series of commitments under the 2015 deal. Iranian official was reacting to statements by outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who, during her visit to Israel, called on Iran to return to negotiations. Iran has already made it clear that it is reviewing technical details to make sure that is all parties fully implement the agreement. The United States says it has held, quote, candid and professional talks with a Taliban delegation in Qatar. The U.S. State Department said the two sides discussed security and terrorism as well as human rights in Afghanistan, among other issues. The department added, however, that Washington will judge the Taliban on the basis of their actions, not words. According to the Afghan acting foreign minister, representatives from the two countries also talked about opening a new page in bilateral relations. Amir Khan Montaghi said the Taliban delegation urged the U.S. to lift the ban on the country's central bank reserves. The group rose back to power in Afghanistan in August, almost two decades after it was ousted in a U.S.-led invasion. The Taliban takeover happened amid a hasty withdrawal of forces, foreign ones, mind you, from the war-torn country. Our second headline story this hour, the Algerian president says the return of Algiers' ambassador to France is conditional on the total respect for his country. Abdelmajid Tebboune said Algeria is not a French colony any longer, adding that history should be falsified. Algeria recalled its envoy to Paris last week, citing comments attributed to French President Emmanuel Macron that Algeria's rulers had rewritten the history of its colonization based on, quote, a hatred of France. Following day, Algeria banned French military planes from its airspace amid tensions with Paris. Beginning the second half with our third headline story, in Chile, riot police have clashed with protesters during a rally by the indigenous Mapuche community. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters, authorities said. A woman died, 17 police officers were injured, and 10 protesters were arrested during the clashes. About 1,000 activists marched in the center of Santiago, demanding autonomy for the Mapuche. The Chilean state has long been accused of discrimination against the Mapuche people, the country's largest indigenous group. Community controlled vast areas of Chile centuries ago, but has since been marginalized. Britain is grappling with fuel, food, and labor shortages that have sparked nationwide panic. The ongoing crises are now threatening the closure of factories. Now, the British government is under intense pressure to resolve these problems, especially when it comes to energy prices. As the winter is around the corner, many Brits are afraid they will not be able to pay high energy bills. Check this out.
Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, you know, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
As I said, as the winter draws closer, Brits face a whole lot of issues. COVID-19 remains a persistent problem, and now they're facing an energy crisis. Many people are on the verge of plunging into fuel poverty, something that plagued many Britons even prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. Each year, thousands die since they cannot afford to pay their energy bills. Here's another report.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people. And that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work is what they think.
The price rises had already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
Thanks for staying tuned in.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
Disturbing new body camera footage appears to show American police officers dragging a paralyzed man out of his car by his hair. Clifford Owensby, a paraplegic black man, was driving on West Grand Avenue in Dayton, Ohio on 30th of September when police officers stopped him. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Nathan Place, writing for The Independent. The piece is titled, Horrifying body camera footage shows Ohio police dragging paraplegic man by his hair. Disturbing new body camera footage appears to show American police officers dragging a paralyzed man out of his car by his hair. Clifford Ownsby, a paraplegic black man, was driving on West Grand Avenue in Dayton, Ohio, on 30th of September, when police officers stopped him. In body cam footage obtained by the WHIO News, a Dayton, Ohio police officer can be heard ordering Mr. Ownsby to step out of his car. Mr. Ownsby replies that he can't because of his disability. "I cannot step out of the car. I'm a paraplegic," he says. An argument then ensues, and Mr. Ownsby asks the police officer to call over his white shirt, meaning his supervisor. "Here's the thing, I'm going to pull you out, and then I call a white shirt," the officer replies. "Because you're getting out of the car, that's not an option. You're getting out of this car, so you can cooperate and get out of the car, or I will drag you out of the car. Do you see your two options here?" Mr. Ownsby asks again that the police officer call his supervisor. At that point, the officer, and possibly a second police officer as well, appear to drag Mr. Ownsby out of the vehicle by his arm and then by his hair. Mr. Ownsby screams in pain. "Somebody help," he shouts. "I'm a paraplegic." The police then handcuff Mr. Ownsby as he lies on the pavement screaming. Incident on 30th of September has sparked outrage on the internet. Ben Crump, a lawyer who frequently represents black clients in police brutality cases, called the officer's actions unacceptable. Dayton Police Department pulled over Clifford Ownsby and violently pulled him out of the vehicle after learning that he was a paraplegic who couldn't use his legs, Ben Crump tweeted. "Cops should treat citizens with respect. Instead, police had no regard for the well-being of this man." The Dayton Police Department says it is investigating the incident. The investigation will include the review of any policies and training when encountering these situations, the police department told the Dayton Daily News. "We ask the public to please be patient while all of the facts are gathered, so we may have a clear understanding of what occurred and why, in order to make informed decisions and continue to improve our services." On Twitter, Interim Chief Matt Carper added that the police department was working to improve its training of police officers. "We recognize that we would all like to see interactions between citizens and police officers handled professionally, cooperatively, and safely," Interim Chief Matt Carper said. "We need to do better, and this can be done by further developing the mutual respect and accountability necessary to make our city safer." Mr. Ownsby himself has also spoken out about what happened. "I just feel like they were wrong for doing what they were doing, and I couldn't believe what was happening to me," he told WHIO News. He also says he's still in pain from the altercation, which he says aggravated an old back injury. The Independent newspaper has reached out to Dayton Police Department for additional comment, but has so far not heard back.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the need for an inclusive and representative government in Afghanistan that will pave the way for peace, stability, and national reconciliation. And we shall discuss the growing international criticism of Taliban's predominantly Pashtun interim government dominated by the group's old guard.
Following its lightning-fast takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August, a comeback of sorts, Taliban pledged to form an inclusive, broad-based government. However, the caretaker setup announced by the group is predominantly Pashtun, filled with mostly old guard stalwarts. The lack of inclusiveness and diversity in Taliban's interim government has drawn sharp criticism from the international community, which believes the group has reneged on its commitments. While non-Pashtun stakeholders have been completely sidelined in the Taliban government, women also have zero representation.
Taliban's interim cabinet, announced on September 7th, is stacked with the group's hardline loyalists in a throwback to the 1990s rule. More importantly, it's dominated by Pashtuns, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. The government is headed by Muhammad Hassan Akhund, the longtime head of Taliban's leadership council and a close associate of the group's late founder Mullah Omar. His lieutenants include Abdul Ghani Baradar, the former lead negotiator, and Abdul Salam Hanafi, the only non-Pashtun member in the group's top leadership. The interim setup, which saw several new additions on September 22nd, is believed to be lacking the representative character, as it ignores the country's ethnic, tribal, and religious diversity. Non-Pashtuns have been completely sidelined in the new governing structure, barring a handful of pro-Taliban Tajiks and Uzbeks. Women have also been cold-shouldered in the all-male government, which has sparked a vicious backlash. While Afghan women, not willing to squander the gains of several years, have taken to the streets in Kabul in recent weeks to protest their non-inclusion, the members of various ethnic and tribal groups are also demanding their legitimate political representation. Their calls have been backed by the international community, including the United Nations, which has termed an inclusive Afghan government with representatives from all ethnic, religious and political groups as critical.
Such a move would be critical and required moving forward if the Taliban wants to operate as a legitimate government of Afghanistan for a long time. These past 20 years have been transformative for the Taliban. They've, you know, rebranded from a guerrilla fighting group into a legitimate state actor once again, and it seemingly they have measures in place to try to sustain the longevity of their statehood this time, instead of, you know, just being in power for 5 years. So in order for that to happen, they must account for the ethnic and religious minorities of the country and Afghan women, and these groups are fundamental components of the social fabric, political fabric, economic fabric of the country. So if they want to revitalize the economy, get it up and running again, if they want people to come to work, especially with regards to public service, then they need to adjust themselves accordingly. I mean, it's very difficult to say how the group will react or how the group will act, especially if we're accounting for the different ideological difference, the various ideological difference within the group in terms of interpretation not only of their theocratic forms of government, but also how day-to-day governance should be implemented. It's much too early to tell how that factionality in the group is going to play out. And, you know, the transitionary government has just been, cabinet has just been announced. So we'll really have to wait and see in the post-2022 context to see when the Constitution Committee is doing its work, what kind of are the long-term plans of the group with regards to ethnic religious minorities in particular and Afghan women, because we know that those particular groups refuse to take things lying down. They have been very active, very vocal with regards to the sustainment of their rights, and that's not going to go away. And the Taliban essentially can't make that go away. This isn't the same framework that they had governed in beforehand.
Afghanistan's ethnic mosaic has been at the center of the country's turbulent politics for more than a century. Taliban's first stint in the late 1990s was marked by brutal suppression of ethnic minorities, in particular the Hazara community. The successive U.S.-backed regimes in Kabul since 2001 only exacerbated the problem. Having staged a comeback after 20 years of war against foreign occupiers, Taliban officials insist that they have changed. But have they really changed? Well, that remains a big question.
Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, in his first news conference on August 17th, 2 days after the group's dramatic takeover of Kabul, struck a conciliatory tone. He promised peace and good governance at home, with participation of different political and ethnic groups. He made all the right noises, which showed the militant group's desire to join the international mainstream and be seen as a credible political movement. Statements by Mujahid and other Taliban officials since August 17th raised hopes that the second coming of the group known for its brutal persecution of ethnic minorities in 1990s will be refreshingly different. Many believe that the experience of past 20 years has led to the militant group's ideological and political evolution. However, words and deeds haven't been in sync so far. One of the factors responsible for Ashraf Ghani's government's staggering fall from grace was his inability to bring together different ethnic groups. During his 7 eventful years in power, he earned dubious distinction for patronizing the majority Pashtun community while sidelining minorities. That has made the job even more difficult for the Taliban. An inclusive, participative and broad-based government is expected to help Taliban gain acceptance at home and recognition abroad, as well as establish itself as an alternative to US-backed regimes that institutionalized ethnic discrimination in Afghanistan over the years. So the choice is clear. Follow the same beaten path or chart a new course.
No country has so far recognized the Taliban government, including Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, the only two countries that recognized the group in the late 1990s. The international community has tied the group's recognition and legitimacy to accommodation of different political and ethnic stakeholders in the government. Heeding the growing cause is particularly important at a time when the war-ravaged country, abandoned by the US-led NATO alliance after a disastrous military adventure, is staring at a major humanitarian crisis due to frozen assets and severe economic downturn.
UN Security Council, in a resolution passed on September 17th, extended the World Body's assistance mission in Afghanistan for 6 months. It also emphasized the need to establish an inclusive government with representatives from all ethnic, religious, and political groups of Afghan society. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a powerful Eurasian alliance, in its summit last month, also sought representation for all ethnic, religious, and political groups in the new political dispensation in Kabul. European Union criticized the interim government of Taliban as neither inclusive nor representative of the country's ethnic and religious diversity. China and Russia, who have moved to assert themselves as key players in Afghanistan, also urged the Taliban government to put in place a broad-based and inclusive political framework. Iran and Pakistan, the two closest neighbors of Afghanistan, expressed concern over lack of inclusivity in Taliban's caretaker government while adopting wait-and-watch approach. Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan even offered a dialogue with the group for the formation of an inclusive government. Taliban, however, shot back saying that countries have no right to make demands of an inclusive government. While the group has so far appeared dismissive of the growing clamor, it realizes that playing the ball with other countries is the only way to avoid political isolation and a worst humanitarian catastrophe.
Afghanistan is a multi-ethnic country of 40 million people, with no single ethnic group being a decisive majority. The fissures between the different ethnic and tribal groups have often played out in the cutthroat field of politics, with Pashtuns almost always prevailing over the Tajiks, Hazaras, and the Uzbeks due to numerical strength. Many Pashtun politicians have over the years claimed the right to rule in Afghanistan, with other groups playing the second fiddle role. The Taliban seem to be following the same blueprint, but as they say, times have changed.
Owing to decades of foreign-imposed war in Afghanistan, no accurate or scientific census exists on its population, including the size of each ethnic group. Pashtun community, based in the south and east of the country, has an edge over other ethnic groups in terms of numbers, but it is not big enough to form a majority, according to multiple studies. There are broadly 14 ethnic groups in Afghanistan, including Pashtun, Tajik, Hazara, Uzbek, Turkmen, Baluch, Pachai, Nuristani, Aymak, Arab, Kyrgyz, Kizilbash, Gujur, Brahui. The first four groups are larger in size, but Pashtuns remain the largest group. According to rough estimates, they comprise around 40 to 45% of overall population, followed by Tajiks and Hazaras with around 15 to 20% each. With no group having a clear majority, presidential candidates have always lobbied with other ethnic groups to form the government. Hamid Karzai did it in 2004, and Ashraf Ghani did it in 2014. But the real representative character still eluded the two US-backed governments. The presidential elections in 2014 and 2019 were both marred by a dispute between Ghani and his Tajik challenger, Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, which illustrated deep ethnic fault lines in the Hindu Kush country. In recent weeks, Panjshiri resistance to the Taliban again showed how politics in Afghanistan unfolds on a complex ethnic landscape.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Iraj Rafiq from Khalq Collective, a collective of Afghan and Iranian revolutionary anti-imperialists. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Rafiq. Now, as we mentioned on the program, Taliban's interim government is stacked with hardline figures from its old guard, certainly not an inclusive, broad-based governing structure. Now, do you think it will affect its legitimacy and international recognition?
Yes, I think having a representative government isn't a bad thing, but you know, the state in society isn't an objective entity. It's controlled by a certain group or a certain class of people who in turn use the state to facilitate their own interests. So in Afghanistan's situation, for example, you can potentially have a representative government, but if that government still facilitates the interests of the most hardline faction of the Taliban, then, you know, what use has that been? So, you know, the US knew who they were making peace deals with when they invited the Taliban delegation to Doha. Without the presence of the internationally recognized Afghan government at the time. And, you know, when they were withdrawing from the country as well, US and NATO. You know, the Taliban took the country within days, you know, 11 to 12 days. And, you know, the Afghanistan government's forces kept being pulled out of all the locations. And in the end, there was hardly any fighting. And, you know, which is good because, you know, fighting leads to violence. And, of course, violence leads to the bloodshed of innocent people, which didn't take place. But at the same time, you know, Taliban took control of the country without any resistance. So this was the intended result that US and NATO wanted. So why all of a sudden is there a change of tune? Why all of a sudden is there, you know, all these stipulations that say, no, Taliban needs to have a representative government, they need to do better for, you know, X, Y, and Z. And all the while, the US and NATO knew exactly who the Taliban were, and they still made the peace deals with them.
Mr. Rafiq, now that the Taliban is back, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid has termed it a transitionary setup. But can the group afford dilly-dallying at a time when the country is staring at political isolation and economic meltdown?
Yeah, I do think, you know, the Taliban have taken a while to get together a constitution. And in the end, of course, they've gone for the, you know, King Zia Shah era constitution, which isn't too dissimilar from how the installed Hamid Karzai government of the post 2001 US and NATO invasion of Afghanistan worked. You know, because the Taliban aren't a unified force, they're not a monolithic force. There's certainly two different factions. You have the Doha Committee faction and you have the Haqqani faction. So the Doha Committee are the relatively more progressive side of the Taliban, and you have the more hardline Haqqani faction. So when they do implement their own constitution, as has been said, you know, that they will do so in 2022, it will be interesting what kind of laws they have, and it would be even more interesting to see how those laws are implemented. in the country. For the time being, you know, in terms of the financial assets and the economy and such, you know, the freezing of the funds and the sanctions that have been placed on the country, you know, this has been taking place by the U.S. and at the behest of the U.S. and other allied Western states. And this only affects the Afghan people. You know, Taliban not having access to these funds isn't going to affect the Taliban so much as it's going to affect the people. You can see this from, you know, the queues every single day outside of banks, and, you know, people waiting to get food for, you know, from places, you know, outside of places like mosques and other charity centers. And, you know, well over 50% of the country is currently living in poverty conditions. And as has been stated by the UN, you know, there's a serious risk of famine for the Afghan people. So, you know, the situation with the sanctions and the freezing of assets must be turned around as soon as possible.
Mr. Rafiq, the international community, including regional countries, is faced with two choices at the moment vis-a-vis Afghanistan: engagement or abandonment. Now, how are the two choices going to affect the country and its people?
We've already seen the effects of what a policy of abandoning the Taliban results in, you know, from 1996 to 2001. So, you know, the alternative is what the U.S. sought initially. You know, they engaged in the peace talks, so-called peace talks, with Taliban representatives in Doha. And it should also be noted that, you know, these peace talks took place without the presence of what was at the time the internationally recognized government of Afghanistan. And so if the plan all along was that, you know, the Taliban would come back into power in Afghanistan, then why all of a sudden have, you know, these extra stipulations on this government? And, you know, because the Taliban will continue to survive for another 20 years the same way that they survived for the past 20 years, but it's the people that will continue to suffer. And, you know, freezing of assets, you know, inflicting sanctions will result in the same kind of consequences for the people of Afghanistan that have resulted for the people in Iran. And, you know, if you continue with this policy, what the UN has predicted itself, that, you know, Afghan people are at a very serious and increasing risk every single day of, you know, facing famines, facing shortness of supplies of food, you know, because there's no access, there's no trade that is taking place within this country. You know, the consequences of abandonment we've seen, but also the fact that at the moment they have sanctions and they have frozen assets of the people of Afghanistan, this is absolutely detrimental to the well-being of Afghan people.
And last but not least, Mr. Rafiq, do you think regional countries, especially Russia, China, Iran and Pakistan, should work closely with the Taliban to ensure the group upholds its commitments and demonstrates real political inclusion?
Yes, absolutely. And I think as well, including other neighboring countries like Tajikistan and other regional superpowers like India, must also be considered, because, you know, all these countries have a vested interest in a stabilized, in a secure and in a peaceful Afghanistan, especially given Afghanistan's geopolitical location, being situated almost you know, within the center of Eurasia. Any laws and any governments in Afghanistan, especially the Taliban government, must be held account to international law. So any kind of talks that do take place on a regional level must be supervised by the United Nations. And any laws that the Taliban wishes to implement must then be held to, you know, universal standards, because you know, people of Afghanistan do need security, they do need peace, but they also need those laws and policies to be implemented respectfully in a non-discriminatory fashion and with basic human rights standards.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Iraj Rafiq for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media on Taliban's caretaker government dominated by the group's old guard, which lacks inclusivity and popular support.
Kenneth Roth, Human Rights Watch director, says Pakistani Premier Imran Khan suggests Taliban will have an inclusive government if international humanitarian and development assistance is guaranteed to it. Taliban spokesperson Sohail Shaheen reaffirms the group's commitment to have good ties with the international community and even expresses readiness to resolve issues through talks. Asif Durrani, a former Pakistani diplomat, takes a swipe at the US, saying they are calling for an inclusive government from the group that was once rejected by then US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Afghan journalist and analyst Hizbullah Khan says Afghanistan is the only country with no recognized government, no economy, no military, and with institutions in shambles. Michael Kugelman, a senior associate at the Wilson Center, points to concerns raised by many regional countries regarding Taliban's caretaker government, saying no one wants to be the first to recognize it.
And that was our episode on the importance of an inclusive and broad-based government in Afghanistan and why the Taliban must heed the calls to take along other political and ethnic groups, as well as women. We shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take care.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. In here. I'd better close the window and turn on the air conditioner. I'm heat intolerant. So this is the window and the air conditioner. So I was telling you that I'm heat intolerant, and guess what? Tomorrow, I'm going to take a tour to Maranjab Desert, to one of the hottest regions of Iran in summer. If you could remember, we had been to Maranjab Desert once before. But our tomorrow's destination in Maranjab is its beautiful caravanserai. Stay with me. Maranjab Caravanserai is a caravanserai and a castle in the heart of the desert. This caravanserai is located beside Aran and Bidgol Salt Lake, north of Isfahan province. This caravanserai was built by the order of Shah Abbas Safavi in 983 Solar Hijri. This caravanserai, with an area of about 3,500 square meters, has 29 rooms. Maranjab Caravansaray is on the Silk Road and was used as a link road between Khorasan and Isfahan provinces. The roof of this caravansaray is built like watchtowers and used to have 500 armed forces who had the duty to provide the security of merchants and goods which used to be passed from China to Europe and vice versa. Maranjab Caravansaray also has a freshwater canal. I'm driving to Maranjab Caravansaray. It's desert and desert as far as the eye could see. To be honest, I love the scenery. It makes me so calm. Around the road, there are different types of desert plants, including tamarisk, alhegi, I don't know the name of the rest. They look very strange to me. So here we arrived, and this is Maranjab Caravansaray. Magnificent! It's made of bricks, which is usually used as a construction material in